Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an American writer and narrative designer for video games. After graduating from the USC School of Cinematic Arts with an MFA in animation, he worked as an animator in Hollywood, contributing to an early version of Shrek at DreamWorks, to Dinosaur at Disney, and to the music video Californication by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. In 2001, my guest joined the video game studio Naughty Dog and worked as the cinematics animation lead on seven titles, including Jack and Daxter and the first three Uncharted games, a series for which he also helped to develop the storylines. He then became a staff writer and narrative designer on Uncharted 4, A Thief's End, Uncharted The Lost Legacy, and the recent blockbuster The Last of Us Part 2. In 2020, he left Naughty Dog after more than two decades and joined Crop Circle Games as narrative director on the studio's first, as yet unannounced, title. Welcome, Josh Scher.
Thanks, Simon. It's really exciting to do this.
I've been following you a long time on Twitter, and but we've never spoken before, have we?
Likewise, no. It's just one of those things.
So, where are you at the moment? You're in your house in California, I guess.
Yep, in my house, in my living room. You know, it's funny. Lockdown happened right around the time that we were just a few scant months away from shipping The Last of Us 2. And it actually, in terms of when that happened, it certainly could have been better, but it could have been a lot worse. We were largely done with the game at that point, and a lot of what was left to do was, by the time they sent us all home, they managed to work out how to get everybody home with machines to be able to remotely log into the machines at work. And they did it very, very quickly. It was actually pretty impressive.
So you got used to working at home pretty soon after that then?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it was obviously a massive shock to everybody, just sort of like trying to, not only like trying to realign like what work is, but just like what life meant. My wife, she worked in visual effects. And so she was also able to do her work from home, and her place of work had to figure that sort of thing out. But, you know, we also have a daughter who at the time was just finishing up second grade. So all of a sudden we went from having, like, you know, a typical life to the two of us working and my daughter attending school in inside this very space.
Yeah, right.
So for the time I was in one corner and my daughter was in the other. That took a little getting used to. You know, I got her some nice privacy screens, which she was able to, like, decorate with her pictures and things like that.
Nice. Is that so she couldn't see all the murder happening on your screen?
Yes. Exactly. You know, like slight tonal whiplash between the two things. There are a few times where she would, like, come over to me while I was in a meeting and she'd be like, "Dad, my entire class just heard you say the S word." And I'm like, sorry, guys.
I mean, for me, and I think for many people, that game, The Last of Us Part Two, is really associated with lockdowns. And, you know, what was it like for you releasing such a major project, you know, in such unprecedented circumstances?
It was weird. I mean, we were obviously very happy with the game.
Sure.
All the emotion surrounding a launch that you would normally have, like all the fears and anxieties and anticipation, then just gets thrown into this weird vortex of uncertainty, even above and beyond what you think the public reception is going to be. There were just a whole bunch of logistical things to worry out, including, like, who's going to make the discs? Is anybody going to be there to, like, actually get the discs manufactured?
Of course, yeah.
We ended up delaying the release. The release was supposed to be May, and I seem to remember we delayed it a couple of months, and it was largely because those logistics needed to be worked out.
Right,
and
right.
Somehow they were. We managed to get not only the digital version out, but the physical as well.
I guess whoever was doing the COVID masks did the PS5 discs on the side.
Exactly. It's all part of the same factory somehow. Yeah. But, you know, there's also what was interesting too was just part of the reception was, you know, I got a lot of messages and calls from my friends who were sort of like, "Hey, Josh, don't take this the wrong way, but I don't know if I want to play your game right in this time of uncertainty and global pandemic and civil strife. You don't want to play a game about uncertainty in a pandemic and civil strife. That's fine."
Right.
By all means. You know, obviously, you know, production on that game started many, many years before COVID was even considered a possibility. And so the timing, I don't know whether you consider it, like, fortuitous or terrible. It is what it is.
Well, it didn't harm the game's performance in any way, did it, or its reception? So, yeah.
No. I think ultimately a lot of people were happy to have a distraction, even if the distraction itself was not necessarily the most comforting game that you could possibly play.
Yeah.
That was Animal Crossing for us, I think.
Yeah. Going between the two, Animal Crossing and then into The Last of Us Part Two.
Both are about communities, you know, taking different approaches to coming together. So, you know, fun.
I didn't have to bludgeon Blathers to death in the final act of Animal Crossing, though.
No, but, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who had some unkind thoughts about Tom. I owe you how many bells?
I'm interested because I mentioned at the start that, you know, I've been following you a long time on Twitter. And I think, you know, you're perhaps one of the more outspoken sort of people who have worked at a major company on social media. You know, you're always very polite and kind. I'm not suggesting you're anything, you know, but that. But you do speak your mind, I think. You know, was that ever an issue for you while you were working with Sony or while you were at a big studio? And, you know, did it change when you then left that environment, or is it, you know, how's that all been for you?
Thankfully, it was never a huge issue with Sony and or Naughty Dog. And a lot of it is just because I try to be diplomatic and conscientious and careful about what I say. You know, I was always very cautious not to say anything that would reflect badly on the company I was working for. But that was sometimes a delicate balance, particularly when it came to, like, political issues. But, like, if I was speaking out about things like gun control or what I thought about the current political climate. You know, right now, I'm not on Twitter as much, largely because Elon Musk has turned it into an absolute cesspool of horribleness that I don't care to spend a lot of time on. And it makes me very sad because as much as I probably used that site just a little too much, it's also how I have met so many different people in this business and got to know them, whether they're parasocially or whether eventually in real life, you know. And, you know, it's how I learned about your work and your writing, you know, now having to go there and having to like wade through all kinds of disinformation and nonsense makes me a little sad. And watching the splintering of that community into various places, you know, I'm sort of like trying to find some new footing somewhere. Sony and Naughty Dog were never came down on me for stuff. They were supportive in that regard. And for my part, I always tried to, at least when discussing video games, to keep things positive. Partially that came out of a sort of a semi-rude awakening when I was playing a game, not going to say what the game was, and there was a point in the game that I was very, very frustrated. Restarts would always play this line of audio. And I basically said, like, I basically tweeted, like, if I have to hear blah, 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 blah one more time. And one of the people who worked on the game wrote back saying, like, yeah, sorry, we know that was a sticking point. And, you know, a lot of things, we just didn't have time to fix it. And I felt horrible. That was just like a very, thankfully, friendly reminder of like the work in games is done by people. And more importantly, the work in games is done by people who are often under credible constraints that we as the public are not always fully aware of. And that nobody ever sets out to intentionally ship a bad game. Like, you know, there's nobody out there doing the equivalent of Mel Brooks's The Producers, at least that I'm aware of. But it's always just sort of a reminder that, you know, there's always humans on the other side of the screen. And so for me, it just sort of made a point. It's like, okay, well, if I have critical things to say about a game or whatnot, that's the kind of thing that I think I would prefer to like discuss among my peers, like in person or at the office or things like that, and not necessarily put it out and have it become fodder for trolls or other people who just want to like bash things.
Yeah, it's a good point, well made. And I think, you know, it's one, as someone who's written lots of criticism over the years, and certainly in my younger years was not that thoughtful of perhaps the people working on it. You know, you have to contend with that, don't you, as a critic as well? Like, to what degree are you, you know, obviously you're serving the audience of readers and the game-buying public who are going to spend their money, but also you have to be mindful of the people behind it, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, it's always a delicate balance. And let me just state for the record that I felt that your review of Uncharted 3 was totally fair.
Oh, gosh.
I think
I would definitely write that differently today. I will say that much. Yeah, I would not write it in the same way for various reasons.
But you know what? You made a lot of fair points. And, you know, I think that's obviously when you work on a game, you're kind of close to it. And like anything is not a perfect score, it can sometimes feel like a dagger to the heart. But that's just part of the thing. You put creative work out in the world, and at that point, it's no longer yours, and people are going to respond to it a certain way, and you can't control that, and you have to just be ready for it. And, you know, hopefully people like it, but even the games that get exceptional, like critical acclaim and whatnot, there's still going to be people who take issue, take umbrage with certain things in it, and that's just kind of part of the deal. And you kind of have to have a strong stomach for it, and it's something that I built up over the years. And you know, my early days were like, what do you mean Jak and Daxter isn't the greatest game ever conceived by man? How dare you? And sort of have to take a little bit of a step back, and because you're a little close to it.
Oh, well, I've got lots more I could ask you about that. But I think, you know, we better turn to the premise of the podcast. So, Josh, I've asked you to pick the five video games that you'd like to put on your ideal fictional video game console. Really excited to get into your five choices. Why don't you tell us about your first one, and actually also some of the thinking behind your choices, because I know that you've employed a particular method for this. So, yeah, tell us about that.
So this was absolute torture, I should say, like trying to distill, because I feel like in some ways it, like, lists can be reductive, obviously, because, like, you know, you're always going to have to leave something out. So the exercise I was doing, like, I was sort of thinking, like, you know, should I do one from each genre, or should I do one from each era? What it came down to was the through line for me, how these different games meant to me and my own career, and also just in my own journey through life in some ways. I did sort of think about one thing that's interesting is that there is a little bit of a through line with a lot of the stuff that I chose. But ultimately for me, I just sort of like see some of it, not only in terms of like my own professional development, but also just like personal development as well. So essentially I have five categories. I called them the catalyst, the sublime, the emotional, the inspirational, and the aspirational. So that's kind of like how it all kind of shook out.
Nice. So we're starting with the catalyst. So what's that?
This was the game that sort of made me think, I want to make games. And I was born in 1970. My first exposure to games was the original Space Invaders. It's not the game I chose, but I like to tell the story, which is that at the time I was six and my parents were supposed to meet a friend at a questionable bar in Georgetown outside Washington, D.C., and they couldn't get a babysitter, so they brought me along. And when we got there, it was one of these bars that had like a pool table and some other casino machines, and they also had a Space Invaders machine in the corner. And my parents basically gave me some quarters and just sat me in front of the machine, because this was the 1970s and parents weren't quite so coddly as they are now. And it's like, here, go play. We're going to hang out with our friends. And I just ended up sitting there for a couple hours playing.
They doomed you in that moment to a life in video games.
here's my super villain origin story right there. And like, some point the bartender came over with a ginger ale and gave me like, hey, you got an extra life. That's pretty good. That all sort of like translated into various things. But no, the first game on my list is a Infocom text adventure called A Mind Forever Voyaging.
Harry lay on his bed and picked up the first sheet of the manuscript with trembling hands. Pages seemed to vibrate with magic, and as he began reading, the magic flowed out of the story and surrounded him. His bedroom vanished in a haze of images and excitement. A brief moment and an eternity later, the story was done. But before the world around him quite settled back into place, Perry knew that more than anything else, he wanted to be a writer.
It was one of Infocom's later text adventures. They, of course, were the creators of Zork, the Enchanter trilogy, and all manner of like these really marvelous text adventures. And I don't know, for the younger people listening, these games were all, as the name implies, text, no graphics, no sound. And you interacted with them through a text parser. You would type things such as pick up rock and throw rock at troll, and the game would respond with blocks of text. Usually these games involved some exploration, acquiring items, and figuring out clever ways to use the items to solve puzzles in order to progress. Infocom always had slightly higher aspirations than some of the other text adventure creators out there, you know, to the point where I remember they had ads where a young man with glasses holding a joystick and the headline said, I was a teenage zombie until I discovered Infocom text adventures. And then there's like a picture of him standing with his parents, like wearing clean clothes and everything. Yes, you know, I am playing the more intellectual game. I went with A Mind Forever Voyaging partially because it was so not only different, but also because it was the first game that to me really felt like it had something to say. Above and beyond, you should go kill that wizard, or like, you know, you should go rescue that person or whatnot. The idea is that you are the world's first fully sentient computer. And the idea is the part of the reason that you have been created is because the world is falling apart, or at least seems to be on a downward trajectory. Certainly nothing that we can relate to in the present day. But and the idea is that in the game, there's a senator, Richard Ryder, name coincidentally has the initials RR, who has proposed something called the Plan for Renewal of National Purpose. And he's going to want to like pass this through Congress, like get it passed and like try to get things to, make America terrific.
Again.
And so the premise is they're feeding all the data from this plan into your computer systems in order to create a simulation of what the world will be like 10 years after the inaction of the plan. And then you, as the player, and as the computer, who's called Prism, that then gets turned into Perry Sim as your character name, enter the simulation. Again, the idea is not that you're going in there to solve problems or like save people or report. you are going in there to observe. You're actually given a list of things that you're supposed to witness, such as like watching a sports game, meeting up with your family, reading a newspaper, using public transportation, just a lot of things, just like sort of living in a society that you're supposed to do. And so you go in and you explore using the commands, like usually used cardinal directions like north, south, east, west. And then you'd like find a newspaper vendor somewhere and you'd buy a newspaper, you would read it, and it would, and through the newspaper, you sort of like learn about things that were happening in the world. And the idea is, as you would go and you record these things, you would report back to your creator, Dr. Perlman. And of course, the first 10 years, everything seems great. What's fascinating is after you turn in the recordings for the first 10 years, there's just this period of time where you're just kind of doing nothing. And then at a certain point, the game says, according to your data banks, you have now generated enough data to do a simulation of 20 years into the future. At this point, you're totally on your own. It doesn't tell you you should go into the system and see what happens 20 years from now and record the same things that you did last time. It just sort of presents it to you. You know, in some ways, this game was in some ways one of the first sort of like open world style settings. And in some ways, it was also the first, you know, not to use this somewhat reductive term, but walking simulator. Like, there was no explicitly stated goal for the player and there was no direction. This drove a lot of people crazy. Like, reviewers at the time were like, I didn't understand what I was supposed to be doing in this game. This is boring. This is not what a game is supposed to be. What ends up happening is that as you continue recording things 20 years in the future, eventually you get 30 and 40 and 50, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. Almost to the point that it's laughable. I love this game, but it is not subtle.
Right.
The sports stadium 10 years in the future that you like go to watch the playoffs 30 years into the future suddenly becomes where they like hold the kangaroo court trials for all the dissidents. And 40 years in the future turns into the Thunderdome where people fight to the death for everybody's entertainment. I mean, it is not so. But even within this, there are some incredibly affecting moments, largely to do with your family. 10 years in the future, your wife, you have like a young child. It's like very bucolic and beautiful. Mm-hmm. Later years, you learn about this, I can't remember what it's called, but basically a highly Christian nationalist style cult that pops up 20 years in the future. And by 40 years into the future, when you walk into your house, your wife is sitting there alone, looking despondent. And before you have a chance to talk to her, your door gets broken down. And all of these representatives of the church burst in with your son, who is now a high-level functionary within the church, and basically says, like, she's the one who poisoned my mind as a child. And they, like, drag her away, and they beat the crap out of you and leave you there on the floor.
Yeah, so remarkable for the time it was made, isn't it? Yeah. Incredible stuff.
And, and you know, it was also the first, like, overtly political game that I remember playing. This is a game that basically, it has a political viewpoint. It was apparently quite controversial even within Infocom itself. There were a lot of people who felt that they shouldn't put out something like this. And interestingly, the person who fought most stridently to have it included was Dave Liebling, creator of Spellbreaker and other things, who apparently was the office conservative. And he says, like, he basically said, it is important that we put this out because if I want to make a game that expresses my own viewpoints, I want to be able to as well.
Yeah.
And that was also, and that is ultimately brought it out. And
he went on to make Call of Duty.
Exactly. It's funny. I do have one funny anecdote about this, which was like, so I played this game when I was in high school, and at a certain point in 11th grade, one of our English teachers, he gave everybody an essay assignment, which is basically like, write about what you want. So I wrote an essay about A Mind Forever Voyaging and interactive fiction and how this is something that I saw was going to become a thing like in the future. My teacher, Bob, was like, oh yeah, no, this is fascinating. And 2 weeks later, he came up to me and said, Josh, I just wanted you to know that I was inspired and like, I wanted to try one of these. So I went out and I bought one of these games for me to try for myself. And I was like, oh really? Which one did you buy? And he said, it has this really interesting name, Leather Goddesses of Phobos. And I was like, oh my God, You picked the sex satire one. Oh my God.
Maybe that wasn't an accident after all.
Maybe.
Maybe he knew what he was doing.
You know, in some ways, the game also opened my eyes to politics in general.
Right, yeah.
It was something where, you know, you live in Washington, D.C., that's what everybody talks about.
Yeah, I was going to say, so, you mentioned that Space Invaders anecdote. What were your parents doing to have you in Washington, D.C. at that time?
They both worked for the government. My mom was an audiologist. She worked in oral rehabilitation, which is to say, like, you have all these soldiers who've been standing next to live munitions and using guns their entire career and now need hearing. My dad worked for the State Department and was actually a writer and an editor for a lot of the things that went out through Voice of America and the United States Information Agency. His particular beats were terrorism and chemical warfare, which led to quite a lot of lovely dinnertime conversations.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so they were both fairly enmeshed in it. Sometimes after school or camp, I would be dropped off at my mom's office just to like hang out. And so I'd meet a whole bunch of folks from the Army and such. And then there were days that I would go to my dad's office and I'd be sort of sitting and like drawing and doodling because, you know, we didn't have iPads then. My dad would be talking about some crazy foreign policy stuff with these high ranking officials or whatever. I would probably flip if I knew who some of those people were.
Yeah.
But,
so at what point, you know, I mentioned in the intro that you go on to work in the animation industry, having gone to USC to study in that field. What took you down that path? Was that something that you wanted to write from a young age, wanted to work in art?
I used to want to make games. And a lot of the early games I made were these Infocom style text adventures, largely because doing graphics on an Apple II like involved knowing assembly language, which to me was still like this weird arcane magic. So I went with what I knew.
Fish.
But then I was super into visual effects for movies. Like I see Star Wars and like, I want a lightsaber. My parents, they're not real. And it's like, oh, well, what do you mean they're not real? I see one. How do they do that? And, you know, eventually I learned how all that stuff was done. And that seemed like something that I was interested in doing. That's all sort of came to a head with my own interest in animation and sort of doing it as a hobby. I graduated college in 1993, which happened to be the year that Jurassic Park came out. And this was, of course, the first film that showed that CGI was going to be the way forward for film visual effects. USC's Cinema TV School happened to be starting up a master's degree program in animation that very summer. And because it was so new, they were still filling up slots. So on a whim, I applied and sent them a VHS tape of all the animations I'd done so far. Much to my surprise and delight, they accepted me very late in the summer. So I basically had to move my entire life out to Los Angeles in the span of about 2 weeks. But yeah, it was there that I was exposed to a lot of the high-end technology that was being used for films at the time. And also because it was part of the film school, I was able to take all these great classes. The funny thing is the very first place I worked was, in fact, a video game company. It was part of the visual effects studio, Digital Domain, which is the one that James Cameron and Stan Winston had started. They had a new media division, which, of course, you know, every Hollywood studio at the time was just like, oh, hey, right, this was successful. Yeah. We should get it. But they were working on this PlayStation 1 game that was kind of like extreme sports arcade-y kind of deal. And
right.
Long story short,
directed by
out.
James Cameron.
Yeah. No, I wish. No. The game was not good. Digital Domain Media did, however, have a very, very big success story with Barbie fashion design, which they produced.
Okay. Well, we'll pick that up in a minute, Josh. We better come to your second game because time marches on. So, tell us about this one and why you love it. What's the game?
Right. So this one falls into the category of the hypnotic. These are the games that, like, when I play, I just sort of like feel like I'm somewhere else. And this game for me is Rez. I missed it when it was on Dreamcast. I first learned about it when they moved it to PlayStation 2. And I was really listening to a lot of electronic dance music at the time. When I first saw the title, Underworld, who was one of my favorite bands, like had a track called Res. It's like, oh, I wonder if this is a collaboration. That's cool. And it's like, oh, wait, no, it's not. But I bought it. And the thing that I loved about it was all the things that Misoguchi and his team were doing in terms of like the idea of synesthesia, the idea of like, here is gameplay fused with visuals, fused with music all together. Just the way that they were able to put that all together was just, in addition to being fascinating for me, it's also I found very engaging in some ways, very relaxing. And what ended up happening was Res was the game that I would play when I came home from an especially hard day at work. Like, I would just pop it into the PS2, and I knew that if I played it successfully start to finish, it would take about an hour. So it almost became like this meditative practice.
Oh, amazing. For me.
And granted, like, you know, it's a fairly intense game, so it's not necessarily meditative for anybody. But the thing is, you know, some people, you know, some of the complaints I hear levied against it is that, you know, that's too short, or that the entire thing is on rails. But that's what was appealing for me. Like, I can play this game in one sitting. And more importantly, I can learn it so that it becomes almost muscle memory. And then it just sort of becomes, you sort of like fuse yourself with it and dive in. And there's also something, in the same way as some of the other games on the list, there's also something oddly optimistic about the game. It doesn't really have a story per se, but there is a theme to it. You are trying to set someone or something free. And the entire last level with the Adam Strickland track, there's this whole story about like evolution and evolving and becoming something that's like greater than yourself. And that also sort of like spoke to me on a subliminal level, because it wasn't like this overt thing that the game was about, but it was just kind of there.
Yeah, incredible game. Gosh, so good.
You know, one thing that I think part of the reason that I love the fact that I can still play it today and easily. Like, it's not something that I have to like have an emulator for, or I have to like go to an abandonware site or something. And part of that I think is due to its design and not in its art direction.
Sure, sure. Like,
it is, the music is great, but the graphics themselves are very simple. It's all like vector lines filled in things. So all you're really doing is up-rising it. I mean, and not to say that that doesn't involve some work, but it's very different than, say, like taking a PlayStation 1 era game and then somehow translating it into like the modern age. Like, and you know, there's been a lot of remasters of a lot of games, and you know, when I've been fans of the original and I play the remaster, for me there's always something lost. And even though they tend to look nicer and everything else like that, there's always some, I mean, by way of example, the Shadow of the Colossus remake, you know, beautiful work, they did an amazing job, but you know, Ueda and his team had like done something where like they took advantage of the limitations of the NTSC palette to give that sort of glowy daydream feel, which is a little too sharpened out in the remake. So it's just these little subtle. But anyway, Res always looks good.
Yeah. Yeah, every time you play Res after they update it, it just feels like Res again. You're like, oh, this is surely how it always looked, right? Even though it's because it incrementally sharper and better, it always feels the same as it does in the memory, doesn't
and
it?
One of my favorite recent experiences was getting to play, I got to play the E3 demo of the Area X, the part that was included with Res Infinite, and just like me in a dark room playing it for the first time. It was weirdly emotional. It was sort of like,
yes,
it like got like the shivers at times and things like that. It's just like,
yeah, the soundtrack on that level is quite transcendent as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's just marvelous.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So yeah, let's go back to your story, Josh. I want to ask you about working on this early version of Shrek. You know, what did that work entail, and how did the version that you were working on look different to the one that we all know?
Oh, it's wholly, wholly different.
Really?
It's fun. Yeah, no, it's funny because, like, you know, much like games will sort of go into a prototype phase and then possibly go into production, you know, obviously film and animated film in particular will do. And this is no exception. So when I joined, Chris Farley was going to be voicing Shrek, and it was actually a much, much darker version of what ended up happening. Like, there was no, you know, I don't think Smash Mouth would have started the movie off with All-Star. It was a lot less bright and cheery.
The donkey had trauma.
Yeah, it was probably leaning into, probably wasn't an R rating, but it was leaning into a pretty strong PG-13 kind of thing.
Really?
Huh. And apart from that, from a production standpoint, we were doing some really cool and interesting things with, like, facial animation. Part of the idea was that it was going to be done motion capture, and not just any motion capture, but puppeteered motion capture.
Oh, wow.
They built essentially a suit for the person playing Shrek where they gave them, like, much bigger feet to put on. They had this sort of string of hula hoops that he sort of, like, wore around the body to sort of, like, capture the jiggle and wobble of his giant belly, all these sort of things. And gotta be honest, it didn't look great. Because what ended up happening was, like, the actor is, like, walking around in these giant, like, clodhopper shoes, and, like, not walking naturally. As a result, the jiggling was too much jiggliness. Long story short, we produced a 30-second animation test, and Jeffrey Katzenberg looked at it. He's like, yeah, we're not doing this. and at that point, pretty much the entire crew up to that point was laid off. And it was partially because DreamWorks had just purchased Pacific Data Images, a visual effects right. company up in the Bay Area.
And okay.
PDI went on to create Ants and then eventually Shrek for them.
Interesting.
What's funny, though, is that there are still people on the internet who are just, like, looking for, like, the lost Shrek footage. And
is it out there?
I have not found it.
You don't have it on an old hard drive or anything?
No. It would have been a VHS tape, if anything.
Right, okay.
But yeah, like, there's seen a few stills from it. I'm here to tell all those people looking, just like,
let go.
It's not good.
So I'm interested, you know, I know you didn't work in VFX for a really long time, but you were there for, you know, a few years, weren't you? And you said that your wife works in that industry. There's been a lot in the press in recent years about the culture of overwork and overtime in VFX studios. I actually wrote a piece for Wired about this. For GQ earlier in the year. You know, was this something that you personally encountered in your time working in the industry, or was it sort of before the real, the really tough working conditions?
Oh no, VFX, it was always there. I mean, you have a creative field, and you have a bunch of people who, particularly in, like, the early days of CGI, everybody is wanting, to some degree, everybody was there wanting to, like, prove out that this was, like, a viable way forward and prove out that the technology exists, because obviously there's a lot of pushback. But you also just had, in some ways, a mentality of, like, oh my God, can you believe that they're paying? And which, of course, is not the mindset that you want to go into, but that is what's happening. I started in the field when I was 25, and, like, it was, like, literal dream come true kind of thing. But, you know, Digital Domain, at least when I was there, you know, we were not paid overtime. We worked it anyway because we're like, oh my God, we're so lucky to be doing this. That was sort of like the early days of overwork. And then what it sort of vaguely transmogrified into the effects was, in some ways, a race to the bottom, where you had all these visual effects companies always sort of trying to underbid each other so that they could get to work. And then, of course, when you underbid, what you're saying is, oh, that studio said that they could do it with 100 people in 10 weeks. Well, we can do it with 10 people in 5 weeks. It's a very tough thing. In fact, that Red Hot Chili Peppers video that I worked on, that entire thing was done in the span of 3 weeks. That's not very much time. And I was there literally every day, probably like anywhere between like 12 to 14 hours every day, at least just every day for like 3.5 weeks, and practically lived at the studio.
Well, it was all good preparation for a career in the video game industry, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was.
Right, we're going to come to your third game then, Josh. Tell us about this one. You've already mentioned the director. Tell us about this game.
So this third category sort of for me comes into the emotional. And like, I remember when King's Quest IV was being marketed, there was going back to like early Electronic Arts marketing, they had this whole thing. It was like, can a computer make you cry? And my response was basically to, you know, roll my eyes. As fidelity got better, as narrative and storytelling got better, and as various things got better, it sort of like started getting to that point, like, you know, like actual genuine emotional response. This was actually a hard one for me to choose because I have a lot that I can choose from, but the one that I always go back to is Fumito Ueda's game Eco. This was, for me, a formative experience for a number of reasons. You know, this was a game that didn't necessarily get a ton of marketing. I, like many people at the time, I played the demo on the demo disc, if people remember demo discs. What struck me about it when I played it was just how different it was from everything else that was out at the time. Everything, this is 2001. So everything else at the time is like loud, bombastic, and in your face, and like extreme. This was a game that was quiet and spare and contemplative. The music came in minimally. It was just these beautiful soundscapes of like distant waves crashing and winds blowing and birds chirping. It was just so different and peaceful that it was, you know, it really made an impression on me. I was sort of like, okay, yeah, I have to play this game. And not only that, but so much of it was communicated without dialogue. The cutscenes in the game were very few and far between, mostly for establishing. And even within the cutscenes, there's always minimal dialogue. Like, I seem to remember the intro where your people from your village bring you, the boy, to the chamber to be imprisoned forever. The only line of dialogue I remember from that entire sequence is them saying, like, do not be angry with us. This is for the good of the village. And that's all you need. You just see a boy with his wrists bound being taken by horseback to this mysterious castle and being entombed in this thing. And you're just like, that's all the setup you need. That's all you need to know. And even later in the game, when you meet and free Yorda from her cell, when she speaks, her speech is subtitled with weird glyphs that aren't translated. So much of it has to be inferred. And yet, despite all these things, I'm not even going to say necessarily limitations, but like, you know, constraints that they place on themselves, you form a bond with Yorda. And sometimes it's just this very simple little visual thing, such as always running through the castle with her holding hands. And there's a sort of like a little bit of a herky jerky motion because she's a little taller than you and not quite as fast and spry. It's just sort of like this genuine affection that you sort of see developing between the two. She's a lot more frail and delicate, but, you know, she, through the animation, you know, he is able to convey their blossoming relationship. Like, she's not quite as timid when she's approaching Eco when you call for her. She becomes a little bit more confident herself. Then later in the game, he's able to sort of play with that. When you open the big gate near the end with Yorda's help, you know, the effort of doing so like exhausts her, and she collapses to the ground and you help her up. And I just remember this specifically when you're now running through with her to the bridge that is going to finally take you out of the castle. You're holding her hand and she falters and she falls. And again, all conveyed in gameplay, you just sort of realize how much you've been asking of her this entire time. And you're going back to help this person who has helped you get out, and she can't quite do it, and you're always having to help her. And then, of course, in the whole end game sequence, you know, you're used to being able to save the game on the couches where the two of them sort of sit. It was always a nice touch for me that whenever you restored a game after having not played for a while, that when it faded up, like, they would sort of be like asleep with their heads on each other's shoulders.
Oh, so many lovely touches, isn't it? Yeah.
The thing that killed me was, like, I was fully prepared for it to be a game about, yay, the two of us got out of the castle and now we're happy, we can be free. Sorry that I'm spoiling a game that's, like, you know, 20 years old or whatever. But when you do the bridge and when you try to jump back across the bridge, she's holding on to you and the darkness envelops her and the queen appears and you're like, oh shit, what's going to happen? Then when you defeat the queen and you think, okay, now at last Yurta can be free, and you realize, and she basically gets turned into a little ghostly silhouette at the end. My jaw just dropped. And she picks you up. And I'm getting a little choked up just talking about this right now. And she picks you up and carries you to the boat and pushes you away and essentially says goodbye as the castle collapses around. That just killed me. And it was so marvelous and so unexpected and so beautiful and perfect. It made a huge impression on me. And I sort of wavered between putting Ico or Shadow of the Colossus as this choice, because Shadow did a lot of the things effectively. But to me, like, Ico did it first. And I think it really sort of opened people's eyes as to, like, what was possible. It's just atmosphere and vibe and tone. It's so very good.
So very good. Right, Josh, let's talk about you joining Naughty Dog. So what was that like? what was the company like in those very early days, I guess? So is it 2001 that you arrive? Yeah.
Yep. And, 2001. I was employee number 33. They had finished Crash Team Racing, and they had done about a year of development work on what was going to become Jak and Daxter. And they didn't even have names yet. Like, if you saw the concept art, it would just say Hero and Sidekick. Yeah. And, what was interesting was, having worked in, like, film and commercials and stuff, usually what you would do is you would submit a VHS tape of your demo, and, like, they'd be like, this person looks good or not, and they would hire you based on that. Excuse me, did that with Naughty Dog too, but Naughty Dog, like many other video game companies then and still now to some degree, like, wanted me to essentially do an animation test to see how I could, work with their rigs and work under pressure. And, nowadays, it's easy to get, like, 3D software and other licenses at home. Back then, very few people had computers or that could run Maya or 3D software. So I came into the office and, I kind of, like, came in there feeling fairly confident. Like, yeah, I've been doing this for a while. I think I'm okay. And then I get to the office and they showed me what they were working on. Animation for the main character was so above and beyond anything I had seen in the game. And some of the stuff that they were showing me, just even in the early days of it. And so I basically sat in the office and, like, did the animation test, and, like, I'm just in the corner animating as fast as I can. And everybody, every now and then, someone would be like, hey, you got any questions? Do you have any help? I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm doing fine. I'll take care of it. It's going to be great. And, and much to my surprise, they hired me, and it was a lot of fun in the early days. It was still very much a company that had a lot of people, worked multiple roles. I was one of the first people who was hired specifically to do a certain thing, which was cinematics animation. You still had people who would be modeling and rigging and animating, like, the props and various sundry other things. And, in all my time there, I went through a period of, like, many transitions. And the first of those transitions was actually after we shipped the first Jak, where there was no real hierarchy at the company. And after Jak shipped, they decided this was time to, like, introduce the idea of leads. And a lot of people bristled at that. And so what the leads were in those early days, and essentially in some ways were producers. Like, we were the ones who basically helped plan things out and made sure that everything was sort of, like, moving along as was expected. And, from the animation standpoint, there was still a lot of things that I was sort of trying to establish, like camera language and consistency and all these other sorts of things. But it was a fight. A lot of people just pushed back against it. It's like, no, I'm just going to do things my way.
Right.
And there also wasn't really a structure to sort of push back against that. So if you look at the early Jak games, there's a lot of people who are doing more cinematic style. There's a lot of people who are having the characters talk directly into the camera, which, you know, drove me nuts. But that's just sort of gradually evolved over time as we've got structures and
everything. Yeah, it's like a company learning process, isn't it, I guess?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And tell me about, you know, you were involved in the writing of the first Uncharted. So, yeah, tell me about the process of in devising Nathan Drake. You know, I suppose so the archetypes are, of course, you know, Lara Croft and Indiana Jones, but he's also very much his own character. And how did you go about creating that?
A lot of these early discussions were like Amy Hennig, who's the creative director on the series, and you know, myself and Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley and some other folks, just like trying to sort of hash these things out. And what was very important to us, and this was sort of like the North Star for a lot of folks, was between Bruce and Amy, was that the idea that the cinematics and the story and the characters absolutely sort of had to complement the gameplay. And that's why Bruce was in all of these conversations. It's like, in addition to him contributing to the character, is also like, how does this get reflected in his, you know, in his animations? You know, we don't want him to be like this super agile commando. We want him to be like pinwheeling his legs as he jumps through the air. And we want him to be like making really sloppy punches instead of being like a tightly controlled Krav Maga expert. The funny thing is, a lot of the early explorations with that regard were actually like looking at Johnny Knoxville from Jackass.
Oh, really?
If you dig up some old concept art for him, which is all online, you'll note that, you know, some of his early concepts do bear a slight resemblance to Johnny Knoxville. Just the idea of this guy just getting into these scrapes and just like barreling his way out of it through sheer bullheadedness.
That just makes total sense now you say that. Does Johnny Knoxville know that?
I'm not sure. You know, there is definitely just sort of a lot of like a, well, here goes nothing kind of vibe that we wanted to catch. Because obviously we were, you know, when we showed our first E3 trailer before it had a title, everybody immediately said, oh, Dude Raider. Like, you know, everybody immediately thinks of Tomb Raider. And that was something that was very important for us to distinguish ourselves from.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it, what it ended up being was like Tomb Raider, at least in those early days, were very much like a solitary adventure and very much more about the puzzle solving aspects and also just about the real traversal mechanic aspects requiring skill. And where it was with us, you know, we really started this in Uncharted 1, but feel like it sort of came to real fruition in Uncharted 2. We wanted to be able to tell this rollicking action-adventure story that you felt like you were in control of, but, and at the same time, have skills sort of be associated with the gunfights and the things, and the fisticuffs and whatnot. But to also make it so that everybody could play the game and sort of like experience the story together. Early Tomb Raider games, despite the fact that Lara is like fighting T-Rexes in an underground cavern, did have a slightly more serious tone to them.
Yeah.
And with us, we really wanted to sort of get that more free-spirited, tongue-in-cheek feel. You know, that was something that was also calibrated over the course of several games.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If you look back at the first Uncharted opening scene where like the pirates are coming in, Drake's very cavalier about the pirates showing it. It's like, do you know how to use a gun? Okay, cool. We got this. Cool. Let's do this. Whatever. Shooting people, ludonarrative narrative dissonance.
Right, Josh, I could talk to you about that for much, much longer, but unfortunately, we've got to move on. So yeah, tell us about your fourth game then, which you've put down as the inspirational here.
That's right. So this one is the game that made me look at games in a different light. And for me, again, a lot of different choices that could have been, but for me, this one is Bloodborne. I sort of came into the FromSoft cult a little bit late. This is sort of my entry into it. I tried the original Demon's Souls way back when one of Naughty Dog's designers at the time, Jacob off was like really into it. And it's like, I'll give this a try. And I bounced off. So this is obtuse. This is unfair. What do you mean when I die, like my health bar is reduced by half? Who the hell designed this? I don't have time for this nonsense. And then I didn't own an Xbox at the time. So the Dark Souls game accessible to me. When Bloodborne came out, I was sort of like, all right, let's give this a try. And the same thing kind of happened. Like, I absolutely hated it. It was just like, why am I torturing myself like this? And then about 5 hours into it, it suddenly clicked. Like, it really did feel like I had flipped a switch, where it was like that epiphany, like, oh, I get it. And a lot of it was sort of unlearning a lot of habits that I had from playing previous games, which of course was to like get through them as fast as possible, to be button mashy about things, to not be, it was, whereas this was just like brutal and would just smack you down until you learned to play. And what was also very admirable about that, it was also completely unapologetic. I do feel like games should in some ways try to find ways to allow more people to play them. But, you know, you also have to admire Miyazaki for like sticking with his vision on this, because it is what makes his games so distinct from everybody else's, and also so influential. What I really loved about it, after I sort of came to grips with it, is that I realized that it never was unfair. A lot of the deaths, 95% of the time, was never unfair. A lot of my deaths were due to me not paying attention or picking up on the visual cues or panicking or trying to rush through something. It was also one of the first games I remember playing where I felt like the real like risk and reward dichotomy playing itself out. Here I am with 10,000, whatever, I can't remember the currency of that game, Blood Echoes. Here I am with 10,000 Blood Echoes. Like, do I press ahead a little bit more? Or do I, because yes, I need 15,000 to get that upgrade, or do I go back and like do my thing? And just how much it surprised you, that one creature that like stuffs you in its sack and suddenly you wake up in a completely different part of the game, and just the sheer blind panic I felt, because I did have a lot of Blood Echoes. Like, where the fuck am I? What's happening?
I need to bang this quick.
I did. Oh God. Look for a lantern. Oh God. And that kind of desperation I had never really felt before. And also just the way that it starts off as this gothic horror and turns into cosmic horror very unexpectedly.
Yes.
And the ways that it...
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Just sort of the holy shit moment.
Incredible game. It really is.
And of course, the idea of summoning people too to help you out. All of those things are just so brand new.
Okay, Josh, let's come back to your story then. So... we're going to have to jump forward a bit here. So to when you leave Naughty Dog and you join Crop Circle Games. Were you involved in the founding of that studio? Was it already up and running?
No, Crop Circle was already up and running. That was studio was founded by Jeff Strain, who was a veteran of Blizzard and was the founder of ArenaNet and Undead Labs. And it's one of several companies under a... sort of Jeff Strain's umbrella company, another which is Possibility Space. We're also working on a separate thing. So there were some folks there, but there were only like seven people.
Was that a hard decision then for you? Because you're going from obviously one of the most highly regarded studios in the world to a studio that's unproven.
Yeah, you know, it was simultaneously hard and easy. Like, I was with Naughty Dog for almost 22 years, and I grew a lot as developer, as a creative in that time, and I learned so much working on those games. Obviously, I had a great deal of respect for all the folks there, and I made a lot of friends there, and it was really, really hard to walk away from that. But at the same time, Naughty Dog has just gotten huge. I mean, I was 33 when I started, and by the time I left, I think it was up to something like 350, 380, something like that. And I really missed the feeling of working with a small team. Crop Circle Games at the time was seven people. And by the time we finished staffing up, it's been 60, which is still not small, but still enough so that I can actually like know everybody's name. It also was an opportunity for me to like try a different type of game. Like, unfortunately, obviously can't talk about what I'm making, but Naughty Dog makes a very particular kind of cinematic action adventure, and Crop Circle were making something different. It was, in some ways, time I felt for me to try to stretch my wings a little bit, try something new. And it's also because the studio is fully distributed. It's remote forever. There is no office. We have people all across the country. We even have one person in New Zealand and one person in the UK. So,
okay,
really sort of embracing, really embracing remote work.
Have you ever met up in person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every 6 months they fly everybody together.
This is,
and we met up in Atlanta 6 months ago. We were supposed to meet up in Los Angeles last month. We ended up canceling it because the hotel workers in Los Angeles are actually in the process of striking for better wages and better pay. And the hotel that we were all going to be staying at was one of those hotels that we're being struck against. And much to the credit of management at our studio and Jeff at Annie Strain, we were just like, we don't want to cross a picket line. And so they canceled the event. They actually donated a good chunk of money to the strike fund there.
Oh, fair play.
Yeah. And that was also actually one of the other things that on their website, the Crop Circle was talking about wanting to make games that were about hope, humor, and human empowerment. And so, you know, I jokingly refer to that as the Triple H game, but but it's also something, it was also something that spoke to me. And I sort of started to feel like, you know, if I'm going to make games, I want to make games that not only that I can feel good about, but also that hopefully other people find inspiring, not sort of like in a treacly sort of way, but just sort of like in the same way that like A Mind Forever Voyaging and some of the other games did for me. It was like games that maybe make you think a little bit about your place in the world and, you know, what you could be doing.
Well, that sounds extremely exciting. Yeah. Well, and I know you can't talk about it, but if we imagine that the game you're working on is a loading bar for how complete it is, are we at like 5% or 50%?
Can't say. Sorry.
Okay.
But it's a small team. And
yeah,
what we're trying to do is be ambitious on a small scale. So you are not going to have to wait 5 years for this game to come out. Hopefully we'll be out within the next covers, because a large part of what we're trying to do is, and apart from building the games that we want to make, is also create a sustainable work culture.
Right, right, right.
Not working on games for 5 years and also not working obscene hours to get a game out in a shorter amount of time. And we're finding right now like what that means in terms of like our ambitions and our goals, but we're going to try to arrive at a place where we can make something that we're all happy about without, you know, becoming burnt out husks at the end of it.
Very cool.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Right. That brings us to your fifth and your final game, Josh. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. So the last category is the aspirational. And this is sort of like, these are sort of the, I suppose you could call this the professional jealousy category as well. Like sort of like, this is the game. These are the games I wish I was clever enough to come up with. Anybody who knows me knows what I'm say it is, because it's a game I can't shut up. And that game is Outer Wilds. This game for me, in some ways, is like the idea with Outer Wilds, of course, is that you are a space explorer in a tiny little self-contained solar system. And it's not like a game like No Man's Sky or Starfield, where you like have these vast, vast planets. The whole thing is you're essentially trying to solve mysteries. And that mystery, as it turns out, happens to be one, why is the sun going supernova after 20 minutes? And two, why am I caught in a time that allows me to revisit that supernova over? So each of the planets in the solar system is its own ecosystem, almost like these little prince-sized worlds that each have their own particular quirk. One of them has a black hole at its center, and so it's always gradually pulling pieces of the planet towards it. There's another one called the Hourglass Twins, and it's two binary planets, one of which is covered with ash and one of which is a hollowed-out rock. And the ash flows in this pillar over time from one planet to the other. And so one planet gets slowly exposed as the ash goes away, and the other planet gradually gets filled up as the ash lands on. It's just this incredibly imaginative little solar system. So much of what's great about the game is that it's wholly nonlinear. And again, thinking back to Mind Forever Voyaging in some ways, like all you're told at the start of the game is like, hey, you're a space explorer, go out and explore some space. And everything that happens to you after that is your own discovery. Even the fact that the sun is going to go supernova, you're not told that this is happening at the beginning. It eventually happens. What you learn, though, is that the knowledge that you gained from the previous visits is kept in a little computer. So you find the writings of an ancient civilization that was there before you that was uncovering some of these mysteries. And as you sort of like uncover their mysteries, it unlocks knowledge that you need in order to find and access other parts of the solar system.
Good.
Thing that's so amazing for it, you're not only rewarded for your curiosity, but everything in the game is gated by knowledge. There's no skill trees to unlock. There's no bosses to defeat. There's nothing like that. Everything that allows you to access other parts of the game is you putting the pieces together. Sometimes you're told explicitly within the text of the game, but sometimes it's stuff that you just have to like put two and two together. One of the astral bodies in the system is something called the quantum. And one of the things you have to figure out how to do is how to land on the quantum moon, because it's never in the same place. And you get hints, you get vague offside hints about it, but it never explicitly tells you this is what you have to do. And this is a game that I was playing while my 7-year-old daughter was watching. My daughter is the one who figured it out. Because she had been doing some clues, and there was one night we were playing and we were about to put it away. And she just goes, oh, if you blah, 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 I bet you could land on the quantum moon. And I just sat there and was like, oh my God, I think you're right. And
proud father moment.
Oh yeah. And this is already past her bedtime. It's like, we're going to try this. Okay, here we go. And she was absolutely right. And she's like, oh my God, it's like, I have to keep playing. And it's like, no, you have to go to bed. So I tucked her in. But what I did was, as I kept playing, I took a whole bunch of screenshots. So the next day I sort of sat down and was like, okay, so this is what happened.
I like that you didn't wait. You're like, I'll take some pics. Then you'll be fine.
I'm a very busy person. and one of the things that I love about the game is the game is presented as this very sort of slightly arcadey and somewhat whimsical exploration game. Like, you know, your home planet is covered with trees. The whole thing has this vibe of like you're going on a camping trip. It's not like this hard sci-fi thing of Starfield. It's this very sort of like rustic feel to it. But very, very slowly, it starts to become about something very profound. And again, what was amazing to me about it is like there are certain things like the game evokes this sense of scale and wonder and awe that I don't think any other game has ever created for me. Like, especially like sort of in a cosmic awe / cosmic terror kind of way. When you're standing on Ember Twin and you're watching the giant pillar of ash, it makes this thunderous noise and you're so small and insignificant in the face of it that it just gives you this feeling of existential awe and dread all at the same time. But then at the same time, you know, you have this background tale of this ancient race of scientists and explorers who wanted to learn more things, and the risks and the costs that they were willing to take in order to pursue that knowledge, that becomes the whole thing. And then in the end, again, without trying to ruin anything, a lot of the game becomes about accepting that some things are well beyond our control. And what matters is sort of like what you do in the here and now that sort of makes a difference. And again, this is all conveyed not through a series of linear cutscenes. You know, hats off to Kelsey Beecham, who's the writer on this, but in all these old little codex entries and hieroglyphs on walls that you can visit literally in any order. And being able to do that while still telling a complete story, to me, is like the best kind of magic trick. Because it's so far afield of the kind of things that I was doing at Naughty Dog.
Incredible.
My one regret about Outer Wilds is that I wish in some ways it was like more accessible to more people, because the controls have quirks. It takes a little getting used to. They've done an amazing job in post-release of like making it much more accessible, but there is still a little bit of that hurdle to get past it.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, I think Ronan Farrow picked the game and said exactly the same thing, that he wants to recommend it to his non-game playing friends, but it's difficult because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually wrote a 4-page document that anytime a friend of mine says like, yeah, I liked it, but I kind of bounced off of it, I send them this document. It's like, okay, here's how to do it. And in a few places that's actually worked. So we've actually gone through and played through the game.
Amazing.
It's just such a magical game. I will watch YouTube streamers play it too, because it's a game that you can never play again for the first time.
Yeah.
So I watch other YouTubers hit those same epiphanies that I did, just to sort of experience that.
Feel secondhand joy again.
Exactly.
Right, Josh, let's go through your games. So we've got here, this is a classic console, very good choices here. A Mind for Every Voyaging, Rez, Ico, Bloodborne, and Outer Wilds. Yeah, so good.
And you know, the common thread there is like, I sort of realized it after the fact, you know, presenting like, you know, in the face of like trying times, like these are the things that we can do.
What would you like to call your console?
Oh gosh, I didn't even think about this. I may have to record something later and send it back to you. The Eclectic Vision. I'm not sure. That's terrible. Am I really a writer? Jesus Christ. Sorry.
I've definitely put you on the spot there. Eclectic Vision. Well, we'll call it that unless you get in contact and change it. So we've got a working title for now.
Exactly. Working title's fine. I mean, writing is rewriting, after all.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Josh, you've been so generous with your time. We've gone way over what you gave me. So I appreciate that. Thank you for being... you know, for really letting us into, you know, your memories here and your games. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for indulging my ramblings. Like, I think about the old Infocom games where there was a command that you could enter that would always say that would always give you the full room descriptions every single time. If you typed in the word verbose, it would always say maximum verbosity. And that's kind of how I feel like I live my life sometimes. So I appreciate you indulging.
Maybe that should be the name of your console then, maximum verbosity.
I like that. Let's go with that. The verbosity. Yeah, let's do that. That's good.
Great. Well, we are all very excited to see your project as and when it's ready. So yeah, look forward to hearing all about it and playing it. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Simon. I really had fun. This is great.
Thank you so much to my guest, Josh Scher. What a wonderful chance that was to hear from someone who has just worked on some of these huge, towering, blockbuster cinematic games that define much of what the video game industry is to many people in the world. And it was wonderful to hear about his journey from a VFX artist working ungodly hours on the Shrek movie and on Red Hot Chili Peppers music videos, through to joining Naughty Dog, working on Jack and Daxter. And then his role, I guess, shifting from being a cutscene director, cinematics director, to more of a co-writer on the Uncharted games and on The Last of Us Part 2. Like I say, I've been following Josh's work for a long time and I really appreciate his insights and the way he conducts himself on social media. I think he really finds a good balance between being outspoken and but also respectful, which is not always... always a combination that people can pull off, but I think Josh does so very, very well. He caught me off guard a little bit, I'll admit, in the early section of that interview when he brought up a review of mine. This was a 2011 review for Eurogamer of the game Uncharted 3 Drake's Deception. This was back in the day when Eurogamer gave out scores out of 10, and I think I reviewed the game, and then you have to give these things a score. I give it an 8 out of 10 because at that time I think I was, felt quite, dogmatic about the idea that video games should be sort of tending towards more open world designs that accommodated player decision making rather than the sort of very highly linear cinematic approach of the Naughty Dog games of that era in particular. And yeah, it caused a bit of a storm online in that way that perhaps sort of reviews could at that time, and I don't think they really can anymore, but yeah, did at that time. People were very, very cross with the review, and got a lot of heat for that. It had its supporters as well, of course, but I don't know, I just remember it being a very dramatic time. There was even the sketch group at the time, Mega 64, which was, a very popular sort of comedy film sketch group, even did a little skit about it called Mega 64 Modern Game Journalism, the movie, which I've just looked up on YouTube, and it's had nearly 500,000 views. And that was all about a reviewer who gave Uncharted 3 slightly less than the 9s and 10s that it was expected, gave it an 8.5. Anyway, there was a big circus all around it at the time, and I guess was just the internet being the internet, but it seemed to sort of encapsulate that thing where the marketing cycle of a big video game coming up has sort of excited the audience to such a degree that anything less from a reviewer or a critic than total adoration feels like a personal attack. And I certainly got an awful lot of hate mail at that time. But Josh wasn't referring to all that. He was talking about the content of what I wrote, which I think was probably a little bit, I would write it differently today. Anyway, just a little context for what that bit of the interview is about. We will, of course, all be watching what Josh is up to carefully with Crop Circle Games. It sounds like a very interesting model for a studio. Certainly, in creative terms, this idea of making smaller, more manageable projects that can come to fruition in a sort of shorter time frame, perhaps allowing a team to take some greater creative risks when the financial risks are a bit reduced. Hopefully that's going to lead to some interesting work for sure. So yeah, let's pay attention to Crop Circle and what they're up to. Certainly look forward to the announcement of that game, which I assume is going to be made at some point in 2024. Right, I'm pleased to say we have now reached the quarterfinal stages of the My Perfect Console of the Year tournament. If you've been at all invested in that, and lots of you have, we've had hundreds and hundreds of people have voted in these. So yeah, very, very thankful if that's one of you. This is essentially the 52 guests that I've had on the show this year have created 52 consoles, as you'll be aware by this point. And they've been put in a randomized set of head-to-heads in a knockout tournament. We're now in the quarterfinal stages. Let me run these down for you now, because I can, because there's not too many of them left. So we have Jason Schreier's Press Sneak Box is up against Marie Leconte's The ML Cube. We have Charles Cecil's Humdinger is up against Heather Ann Campbell's The Only Play. We have, I think it's fair to say, one of the big favourites here in this next knockout. So that is Phil Fisher's Fez 2 is going up against Brian Lee O'Malley's Puffin. And finally, we have Grace Curtis's Storybox up against Clint Hocking's Non-Soul. So yeah, there we go. If you would like to vote in the quarterfinal stage, up until now, the public have been able to vote, but now it's only for Patreon supporters, I'm afraid. So if you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, you can do that by heading to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. If you sign up there, you'll get loads of benefits, one of which is you have the opportunity to vote in these face-offs for the quarterfinal, the semi-final, and the all-important final. And then I will be announcing the winner of the tournament around Christmas Day. I think I'll put out an episode announcing that to everyone. I'll keep it a secret up till that point. But anyway, if you'd like to vote, get on that today. Yes, it would be lovely to have you as part of the community, even and aside from the tournament. Right. Thank you to those of you who've been writing to me suggesting guests for 2024. Loads and loads of you have done that with some great suggestions. I've got a really long list that I'm going to start sending out some emails and booking in guests as we go into the new year. So, yeah, if you'd like to do that, you can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Really easy to remember. So yeah, send us an email. And yeah, if you've been enjoying these this year, then please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. On Spotify, you can just leave a star rating. On Apple Podcasts, it'll take you 20 seconds longer. You just need to jot down your thoughts. It does help other people to find the podcast. Also, some lovely news. So Vulture, which is the very, very popular website run by New York Magazine in America, looking at all things culture, put My Perfect Console in its best podcast of the year list. What an amazing thing, because that's a very well regarded website, and it's a lovely, lovely write up. So yeah, if you'd like to read that, then you can head over to Vulture and just search up their best podcast of 2023. But yeah, thank you to all of you who have listened thus far into this episode and also into the year. It's really helped bring the podcast the attention of the cultural tastemakers, such as the good people of Vulture. Right, next week, it's the final guest of 2023. It's a really good guest. So, Nolan Bushnell. He is the co-founder of Atari back all the way back in 1972. Is that the year he founded it? It's around then anyway. He's also the co-inventor of the very first arcade machine, Computer Space, and of course the co-creator of Pong, the sort of table tennis game that really defined the 1970s video game industry. Was of course the game that was put on the Atari VCS, which was the first console, or one of the first consoles, of course, after the Magnavox Odyssey. But yeah, probably the console that really defined the early years of the video game industry was the Atari VCS. Yeah, and so wonderful to have Nolan on the podcast. He is in his 80s now, so it doesn't do that many interviews anymore, so I was very grateful for him to take part. And yeah, I mean, such a treat to hear him talking about really how he helped establish the reason that we are here today talking about video games. I think video games were inevitable. Someone was going to invent them, and of course there are lots and lots of different people who lay claim to being the inventor of video games. Willie Higginbotham, who also worked on the Manhattan Project. If you saw the recent Oppenheimer film, Willie was one of those scientists who was watching what was going on. He designed the timer on the atomic bomb, and then after the Second World War becomes a sort of person who's very against or campaigning against nuclear arms. He, lays claim to, in the 1950s, designing one of the earliest video games. But there are lots of other individuals in the 1950s and 60s who did that. I think it's fair to say that Nolan Bushnell, however, is the person who brought all that together, who came up with the way that it was going to be marketed and packaged it in this brilliant product. Of course, I should make mention of Ralph Baer, because all the video game historians are probably hurling things at their speakers at the moment. But yeah, so anyway, we get into some of that history. Don't worry, we do cover that stuff. And Nolan tells us about his memories of that time, really, and of this industry that he was so instrumental in birthing. So yeah, join us again next week for Nolan Bushnell, his five games, and one more perfect console.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.